on samosas and Diet Coke since I've been here. Could you set that timer to the correct time for me? That would be great. My name is Scott. You can go and Google with Bing for Scott and learn about me. Got to be a good corporate citizen. I work for Microsoft. I apologize. But I work in Portland, Oregon, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. I have a podcast that I would encourage you check out. It's 30 minutes long. It's meant to be what's called a commute length podcast. So in Nairobi, you're going to want to listen to four or five of these and during one commute. In the U.S., though, you barely get through one. It's a great show with lots of interesting people talking about lots of interesting stuff. You can also check out another show I do called This Developer's Life. They're very good shows. They make me happy, and I enjoy doing them. So I work for Microsoft, as you know, but I don't live and work in Seattle. I live in Portland, Oregon, which is kind of on the forest moon outside the gravitational field that is Microsoft. And I work in open source, which is really nice. And I've actually been here a number of times. My wife is Zimbabwean, and we've been married for 15 years. So I've been in and around Africa for very many years, and it's very important to me that my kids grow up knowing the continent and that they can be successful business people, whether they decide to live in the U.S. or they decide to live on this continent in any one of many different countries that they could potentially live. So I work in open source. When I started Microsoft, I was moving to this big giant company, and all of my open source friends said I was a sellout, right? And they're like, oh, you're going to work for Microsoft. They're going to give you all this money. And it really hurt my feelings. It made me really sad. And I don't really know. I had to. Somehow I was able to work through that, though. And it's worked out pretty well. Because before Microsoft, that was a picture of me there on the left. This is me. And then this is me after Microsoft. So it worked out pretty good. Microsoft has a pretty confusing org chart. I know there's a lot of different people here. This is our org chart. It's pretty complicated. So what I want to talk to you about today is this conversation that I had with an older person who was working at Intel. And this older person said that they wanted to become a web developer. This was a very old man, probably like 100, 120 years old. This is a picture of him taking a selfie, just to give you a sense of how old this guy was, okay? This guy was super old. Like, he wrote programs in a language called Lisp. You know what Lisp is? And he's the type of person who would look at some code like this, and he would say, oh, you're missing a parentheses. And then he would just know exactly how many parentheses to add. It was crazy. This is the kind of person like, you know, like Grace Hopper, who invented the compiler. Super, super old, but also very uncomfortable, because I've been in the software industry for 25 years. This is someone who'd been doing software for 40 or 50 years. And this person said, I want to learn about being a web developer. So I started thinking, how would I teach someone what is it like to be a web developer if they were a smart computer science person, but they skipped the last 20 years of the web? Like, all the sucky parts, all the animated GIFs and all of the nested HTML tables, right? How would you teach them? So I said, well, let's talk about the cloud and what that means, and let's talk about the browser, okay? So there's this quote, and I use quotes all through my talk. This is a great quote that says, I think there's a world market for maybe five computers. You've ever heard that before? It was Thomas J. Watson. I guess he was the CEO of IBM at the time. I don't know if that's a real quote. I can't prove it. I don't even know what this guy looks like. But I do have this really old book. So I'm just going to say that that was the guy. Because if I'm making up quotes, I'm just going to make up faces of people as well. When he said that, what did he mean, right? Five computers. He meant like refrigerator-sized computers, right? And there'd be like the African computer, and there'd be the Europe computer, and they would sell five, and that would be it. And they've sold all the computers, right? And now, if you go see a movie like Hidden Figures, this phone has more power than all the computers that they were working on. And what actually happened is there is five computers. They're just clouds rather than refrigerators, right? There's the Google computer and the Microsoft computer. I guess there's a popular bookstore that has a cloud. There's all these different five computers. Here's a picture of Azure. I realize that we're second, so we're a little bit behind, but we're getting color, which is great. And I'm very pleased to it. Here's a upgrading Azure on a regular basis. We're getting all kinds of new stuff. So Azure's going to happen, and this guy is really, oops. There we go. He's really happy about that. So I asked this older gentleman at Intel, I said, let's talk about what it means to say the cloud. The problem with the word the cloud is it gets overused by young people. And they just use it like it's hosting, right? What is the cloud? Is it just hosting? Well, it's more than that. It's the ability to have unlimited virtual machines in an elastic way. So I said to the person at Intel, let's start with this. This is a diagram that you learn in school that describes what an operating system needs if it's going to be an operating system. It has to have memory management. It has to have, you know, graphics subsystems and networking and APIs. And I said, do you know what this means? And the person at Intel said, yes, I invented that. And that was awkward. But what's exciting is when that becomes virtualized, that the first time you ever saw a virtual machine, or the idea that you could put a virtual machine on a thumb drive and take it places. Does the virtual machine know it's virtual? Right? It doesn't know. You're lying to the virtual machine, right? You remember the movie Inception? You've seen that movie? That movie is about if you run a virtual machine inside another virtual machine, time slows down. Yeah? Now you know the movie. I've spoiled the movie. I asked the guy at Intel, how do you get virtual machines? Some of you may work in IT. He said, well, I have to fax the IT people a permission slip, and then they will provision a virtual machine for me, and then in a week or two, I'll have an IP address that I can talk to. And I said, that's not the cloud, right? The cloud has to be automatic. I have to be able to go somewhere and say I go to like VM Depot and I want to have this Ubuntu machine here and I want to go and talk to Azure programmatically. It's the programmatic nature of the cloud that makes it the cloud. I can call an API and a virtual machine gets made. I can go to the command prompt here and I can type Azure. And then I get ASCII art, which means that Microsoft isn't evil anymore. And then I can talk to Azure, and I can say, Azure VM create, and I can make a new virtual machine. That's the cloud. But the problem with the cloud is that you have to manage the virtual machines. When you make a machine for your startup, for your small business, you're responsible for that virtual machine. You have to run Windows Update. You have to run apt-get update. You have to keep it the security patches. You just want to make the next great startup. Or maybe you want to manage an expense reporting application. Why am I suddenly responsible for this virtual machine? It's free, it's great, hey, virtual machine, but it's free like a puppy, where it's like, hey, cool, a puppy. But now I have to keep it alive and water the puppy and then run Windows Update on the puppy or whatever. I don't have a dog, so I don't know how it works. But it's a hassle. I don't want to have to think about those things. So you want to come up with a higher level. Cloud applications that don't think about the underlying virtual machine is a start. What's really interesting to me are websites or web applications where you have less control, but Azure or whatever cloud it is manages the operating system update for you. That's what's really interesting, and that's where the power happens. The way I like to look at it is like a virtual machine is like your first house. The first time you get that house, you're like, hey, this is great, but I have to learn how to maintain the house. I got to get on the roof and check the house, check the plumbing. None of that has anything to do with living in the house, right? A website or a web application that lives at a higher level, that's like a hotel room that gets put back together after you trash it. Like the hotel room that I've just trashed. Because I'm a rock star. I've totally destroyed this hotel room. And it's going to be perfect when I get back. Because it's platform as a service, right? I don't want to have to maintain this hotel. That's somebody else's job. So the management of those things is taken away from you when you go higher up. But then you ask yourself, is that a good idea that I'm going to have that management taken away from me? Yes, it's a fantastic idea. And here's why. There's a lot of young people out there that are very impatient, with all due respect to the young people. I've been in meetings with 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds where we have to scale the website. Hey, we're going to scale out, make a web farm, right? One machine becomes three or nine. And then you all take the slider bar and you go, ugh, this is taking like 10 minutes to make a new web farm. It took all of the 90s to make web farms. Do you understand what I'm saying? I have a multiple page CV. You have a one page CV. I'm old. I have a 3-page CV. Page 2 is just doing web farms. Okay? Then this comes out. This slider bar has ruined my CV now. It's only 2 pages. Because now I go to the command line and I say update. And look at this line right here. I hate this. Updating a server farm. That was 10 years of my life is gone now. And it's been turned into a slider bar. And the worst part is that you all, the young people, don't know what happened. I move the slider bar and you're like, what just happened? It's magic. People don't appreciate what's going on there. We're standing on the shoulders of giants that worked so hard to make this stuff happen. And then we're in the office working hard and you all are hanging out. You say, hey, can you scale the web farm? Oh, well, it's going to take a couple of hours. I'm going to go work from home. That's the promise of the cloud, though, isn't it? Right there. I'm going to scale the cloud from home. It took me about 13 minutes, but now you're on my side, right? Okay. I did my research, people. The gentleman at Intel said, well, what language should I do my application in? What is a cloud? Do I do C#? Do I have to do C#? Is it the Microsoft cloud? I said, a good cloud doesn't care. Whether it's Microsoft or AWS, .NET, Node, Java, PHP, Python, Erlang, whatever that makes you happy, you should be able to do that. And those languages should all just work. So I told this to the gentleman at Intel, and he couldn't believe it. Became lightheaded. Kind of fell backwards. Woo! Oh, Lord! I can do PHP in the cloud. And it's all open source. This is so important. Your SDKs need to be open source because even though you don't control the cloud, you need to be able to control how you talk to the cloud. You need to have that sense of power. And this is fundamental. But the concept I was trying to get across to him and the concept, you guys missed all the good stuff. Oh my God, it was so good. Good night, everybody. Thank you. I'm looking judgingly. You're going to have to watch the beginning because it was the best part. All of this stuff is downhill from here. I want to talk to people about the cloud and the layers of abstraction, right? Each additional layer of abstraction is indistinguishable from magic. When you go and make a website, there's a virtual machine underneath. There's a computer underneath. But you don't have to think about it anymore. When you scale a web farm, you pull the slider bar, and it scales. Did it really make virtual machines? Did it really make a round-robin DNS load balancer? Yes, it did all of that. But it did it using best practices, and that's what's significant about the cloud. And you have to ask yourself then, who's responsible for which parts of your cloud? I was in Europe recently, and I was at a speech where a guy who was the chief architect of Netflix, I don't have a picture of him, but I have a picture of John Malkovich, so I'm just going to use that. Because this guy was like a British guy with a fancy suit, and he was like a doctor of something, doctor of unsolvable numbers or something. You know how it is when someone is so fancy they got their doctorate, and they tell you they're a doctor right off the bat. I'm Dr. Kumau, I want to let you know, doctor. There's probably 3 Dr. Kumaus here, and then I've offended them. But There, you know, he was a really important guy, and he was English, so he had a very nice English accent, and that gave him +2 charisma right off the bat. And so he says that they were moving their hard drives at Amazon, at Netflix, from spinning rust, right, so hard drives you can hear, to SSDs. Now remember, hard drives that you can hear crash, and SSDs are many, many times faster. So think about this from the perspective of a chief architect, not a developer, a chief architect. He's the CTO type. He says, well, there's 300 IOPS, IOPS input operations per second. It's the measurement that the cloud uses for speed of I/O. 300 IOPS for a dollar, that's with Rust, spinning hard drives. Or for $3, it's like 3,000 IOPS. So for 3 times more money, it's more money, it's 10 times faster. And he talked about how this is going to be great. We are going to spend the money, but it's going to be 10 times faster. No brainer. Let's do it. So then he gives his speech, and we're all like, oh, it's amazing. You're British. And then this kid comes up and says, and I don't, we were in Denmark, and I can't do a Denmark accent, but I can do nerd. He's like, well, actually, you know, SSDs are extremely unreliable, and you are going to find that in the meantime before failure. And he basically told this doctor, CTO, chief architect, PhD, you're an idiot. All those SSDs are going to fail. Why would you do that to your company? And what happens when SSDs, which he believes are unreliable, they all start failing? Why are you asking? Oh, my God. Why are you asking that question? And then we said, what's he going to say? He said, it's not my problem. I'm renting them. Oh. Oh, this kid didn't even know he got cut. It was like a ninja movie where the guy goes like, shoop. And then the head is like this, and then it falls down, and then the brain, and his body, like, do I push him over? How should I say something? What's going to happen? He got destroyed in a sentence. Whose job is it if the SSDs have a problem? It's Amazon's fault. It's not Netflix's problem. Whose job is that? That's theirs. From the perspective of that higher level business person, it was this much more money for that much more perf, and it's their job to provide it, right? This is the hotel model rather than the house model. Okay? This is important. Now, I don't have a picture or a GIF of this kid getting chopped in half. But I do have this one. We'll do that one more time. It was exactly like that. Ah, boom. Awesome. So good. So if you're a cloud architect, you want to be thinking about a cloud that looks like this, right? The cloud is having big TVs with a map of the world on it, right? And just dots where your businesses are. That's the goal of the cloud, is those, this big scrolling dashboard with charts to do stuff. That's the cloud, right? But other people think that the cloud is something else, and they do their dashboards wrong. And then the old people don't believe in the cloud, right? They do this. They think that's a dashboard. That's not a dashboard. And if you go, that's a good dashboard. I use Top. Yeah, HTOP, right? Upgrade. You can't argue that HTOP or Top is a dashboard onto your business. It cannot be argued. This is like the flat earth argument. Like if you, we can agree and then you start arguing the earth is flat, I'm like, okay. Good luck, go with God, right? That's, what else do you say, right? You can't tell me that Mario is the better Mario brother. It's Luigi, it's always been Luigi. What? It's Luigi. No, always Luigi. So what is the cloud, right? It's elasticity, it's a higher level of abstraction, it's the ability to have virtual machines when you want them, and to have applications that hide the underlying virtual machine. That's the cloud. So I'm explaining this to the gentleman at Intel, and he says, okay, I get that. All right, let's talk about the browser. What does the browser mean? And could I impose upon someone to grab me a water or something? Let's talk about the browser, the other side, the client side, not the server side. I said, remember this, right? This is our characteristics of an operating system. These are the things that an operating system has to have in order to be an operating system, all right? Now, there was a time when you would sit down in front of a computer that looked like that, and you would talk to a refrigerator that looked like this. Oh, you're a star. Thank you, sir. That's okay. I'm going to just rip it open and then just splash it all over my face. Just, Thank you. And you would talk to the refrigerator, and then you would load your application. Your application would come up. There you go. And then the application would appear on the screen, right? But where's that work happening? It's happening on the fridge, not on that computer. That's a dumb terminal. A dumb terminal. They called it that. It wasn't meaning to disrespect the terminal, but the terminal was dumb, and the terminal needed to deal with that. The work happened over here. So then this happens. This is the first web page. It was also a dumb terminal. We sent a string across a port over TCP, and it was then rendered on this dumb terminal. And when Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, did this, he thought about this endless series of books, this book that would never end as you would click, click, click through hypermedia. He didn't think of it as an application platform. It was just a place to have physics books and things, right? And I've noticed here, I've only been in Kenya a couple of days, but I've seen some business cards that you've had. And with all due respect to you and your people, you have some pretty fancy titles. Certifications and degrees going off, some of them word wrapping to the second line. I would respectfully share with you Tim Berners-Lee's title. And I would point out that he did not put the in front. He could have said the web developer. He didn't even put senior. So I don't even know what I can say anymore. I just put human. I don't know. There's nothing I can do. Because he's so modest, what can I possibly say? Now, when Berners-Lee made this infinite book, he wasn't thinking about it being typographically perfect. He wasn't trying to make PDFs, right? He was trying to make this markup language. And when that markup language couldn't do things, couldn't do math equations, couldn't do charts and things conveniently, we saw things like PDFs, right? Portable document format. And he could never have imagined that that would become the fifth most popular religion. How could he know? There's no way. So the internet was happening, and then this happened. How did we know that this happened? Because we were browsing the web, and then Java loaded. And then these guys were like, we can do it too, whee, right? And then these guys were like, we've got YouTube, you need us for stuff. What was Java and Silverlight and Flash trying to do? They were trying to do this. They were trying to put an operating system inside a virtual machine, inside a browser, because the web didn't do stuff that they needed it to. Someone asked me in the hallway, why did Microsoft kill Silverlight? The web killed Silverlight. We wanted this, and for some years we did this. We wanted a little virtual machine inside of a browser, but then when we got one, we didn't need those plugins. Now, this can be used for good, and it can be used for evil. I went to, I have a Toyota, so I went to the Toyota dealer, and we're all engineer type people here, so our personalities are similar. You know when you go to the shops and you see them typing away, you like, you want to see what kind of system they're running. You know what's up, right? And then the next thing you know, you're on the other side with them, like learning the hotkeys about, oh, yeah, is that how I upgrade to business class? And so I'm talking to this guy at Toyota. He used to have a dumb terminal that he would talk to a big mainframe in the back. And then I come in one day, and he's got all new Dell. I'm like, hey, that's cool. Oh, and he says, oh, it's so good. Let me show you. Cool, man, show me. So he goes and he boots up Windows XP. And I was like, oh. So that's okay. And then he loads Firefox. And then he loads a jar file, a Java jar file. And then Java says, are you sure you want to run Java? And then he's like, yes. And then it says, the government has decided that Java is bad for your health and causes cancer. Are you sure? Type, I know Java causes cancer. Types it. And then he loads up a terminal emulator inside of the browser running on Windows XP and then terminals back into the same mainframe and tells me, this is so much better than it was before. Our users don't expect proper applications. We're poisoning them. We're giving them these ridiculous apps that have a little bit of text, a little bit of HTML, and then this little island of interactivity, this little window where interactive stuff happens here. That's not what Berners-Lee wanted. That's not how we meant to do this. That's just for like teapot demos and stuff. That's no fun. And Java, on the client side, one does not simply write once, run anywhere. So while all of this is happening, I like Java on the server side, but while this is happening, JavaScript is also happening. Now remember, JavaScript and Java are different things, but it's fun to say Java. So they just named it that, I guess. I don't know. Make sure if you're a Java person and you're also a JavaScript person, don't confuse them. Don't do this. Java people do not like that. They don't think that's as funny as I think. This is a flow chart about what it's like to work in JavaScript. Just to give you a sense of your developer flow, what that feels like, okay? What? JavaScript. Do you remember the first time that you saw JavaScript do something useful? Seriously, for a second. This is for my old people in the crowd here. You were typing in a form, and you filled out your phone number, and you hit tab, and then the field went red. And you went, hmm? And then you went back, and you changed the phone number again, and you hit tab again, and you said, I don't think it posted back to the server. You start poking around, and you realize that they put validation on every form field. You're like, holy crap, the business logic ran in the browser. Maybe JavaScript is better for just alert boxes. So then I grabbed my laptop and I ran across and I was like, oh my God, it worked. And my wife was like, I don't care. And I run over and I'm trying to tell, like, this is going to be huge and amazing. I can't believe that JavaScript is useful. I used to think it was just for like making my surname alert, pwned, and then sending it off into the database and seeing if it would feed it back to me. While we were thinking about maybe JavaScript is useful, other people were doing crazy stuff with JavaScript, like entire computer emulators entirely in JavaScript. Someone sent me this, which I could not believe, and I wanted to share it with you. This is a complete emulation of Windows 98 in JavaScript. Even better, this is a complete Linux distro done entirely in JavaScript. So here, I am going to compile a C application inside of a JavaScript virtual machine, inside of Chrome, inside of Windows. Now, I showed this at an open source conference once, impressed with myself, and someone called out, why aren't you using GCC for the compiler? I'm like, I don't think you understand. I am compiling a C application inside of a JavaScript virtual machine, inside of a browser, inside of, like, what can I do to make this troll understand that this is the greatest thing ever? So on my Windows machine, I decided that I would fire up an iPhone emulator and then go into Safari and then within Safari run a JavaScript virtual machine and then compile a C application. So now I'm running C, running Safari, running iOS. Just because I just wanted the guy to shut up because he was rude. It's not nice to heckle. I'll use whatever C compiler I want to. Thank you very much. So you can do these kind of things. But then there are people who say, well, if I disable JavaScript on your website, will it work? No. No, it will not work. Well, what if I disable cookies? No, that's stupid. The great cookie scare of 2000 is over. Cookies are not going to hurt you. Cookies are tasty, and biscuits are better. You meet these people and they tell you that they I run my browser with JavaScript disabled. Well, then your web is going to suck for you because it's way better with JavaScript. You could do all kinds of amazing stuff with JavaScript. This is actually a game called Contre Jour. You can go and see it at contrejour.ie. It was the iPad Game of the Year in like 2013, and they rewrote the whole thing in JavaScript to see if they could. And the guy who wrote it said he wouldn't release it unless it was pixel perfect. And it was, and they did it. So now we're seeing other kinds of things that you can do with JavaScript, including taking C and C++ and then running it through a compiler called Clang and making bytecode. So we're compiling into JavaScript as if it were assembly language and then talking to WebGL. So this is the part of the conversation. This is the part of the talk where you think I'm going to go and run like Quake in the browser or maybe Doom. You're thinking to yourself, okay, here's where Scott runs Quake in the browser. No. I'm not going to do it just because you want me to. I'm not going to do it. But what I will do is I will take that list of the characteristics of an operating system and I will overlay JavaScript characteristics. JavaScript has garbage collection, has web workers for threading, it has APIs like geolocation, it has a little database, it's got multiple graphics subsystems. JavaScript has all of the characteristics of being its own operating system. That means all of our phones have two operating systems. That means all of our computers have two operating systems that we aren't even using. Now, Atwood's law is that any application that can be written in JavaScript will eventually be written in JavaScript. This is also true of Microsoft Excel. I've seen people run entire businesses entirely in Visual Basic for applications. But you've got two operating systems on your phone there. And you usually call those HTML5 apps. HTML5 has become this overloaded term. But when we say HTML5, we really mean JavaScript, HTML, and CSS3, right? That's what it means to say HTML5. And here's a little tip on how you can tell HTML from HTML5. If you try it in Internet Explorer and it doesn't work, that's HTML5. Now, as an old person, I can tell you that there was a time when the most difficult problem in computer science was HTML tables. You could get a job if you knew tables. You could be a homeless person on the street, they could say, hey, do you know tables? Yes, I do. Boom, you have a job, you're an engineer. This happened to me, I lived this. Then a couple years later, they said, do you know row span? I did. Senior engineer, running the whole company at this point. It's true. And I actually know that the maximum number of nested tables allowed in Netscape Navigator is 32. And the only way that you discover that is when you have written the 33rd nested table and looked Satan himself in the face. I have also lived that. But now I see amazing web pages and I go view source and it's like one div. I'm like, how are they doing this? It's amazing. HTML is just the structure now, right? HTML is the structure. CSS provides the color and the style. CSS is arguably more complicated than HTML. We all know CSS, right? CSS is this amazing expressive language. It always gives you exactly what you want. You just tell it what you want and you get it. It's right the first time. I was trying to work with the Nextech folks, and we were going to give you all mugs that said CSS is awesome. They didn't turn out right. So I found a designer to make it better, so we fixed it. it's still not quite right, but we'll get those mugs out to you as soon as I get that to fit inside the frame there. And then JavaScript is for everything else, right? Now here is a video of the very first time I was learning JavaScript just as a baby. And see, JavaScript is so amazing that you don't even need to learn the bad parts. The red is the bad parts. Now, there's a gentleman named John Resig. John Resig wrote jQuery. We probably all do jQuery work. He wrote this amazing book you should buy called Secrets of a JavaScript Ninja. Great book. But I said, that is a samurai. Why is there a picture of a samurai on the cover of Secrets of a JavaScript Ninja? Samurai. And he says it's because JavaScript is loosely typed. Yeah, I apologize for that joke. That was bad. Now, speaking of quotes, another one of our great philosophers once said that JavaScript is the assembly language of the web, right? You remember who that was? That was me. But it's one of those things that you say that everybody says, right? JavaScript is the assembly language of the web. It's not that original of a thing. But when I said it, I wrote a blog post, and a bunch of people came at me on the internet, because that's what people do, apparently, on the internet. You suck! Thank you, anonymous egg. So I went to the people who invented JavaScript, and I asked them, is that a reasonable statement? JavaScript is the assembly language of the web. So I went and I asked Brendan Eich. Brendan Eich invented JavaScript. And that is actually, that is Brendan Fraser from The Mummy. But I really like Brendan Fraser. That's Brendan Eich. But we'll just stick with Brendan Fraser. So he said that he said JavaScript was the x86 of the web, but he can't claim it's original. It's one of those thoughts that are in people's minds. People thought I was crazy when I said that a couple years ago. But now it's actually happening. We are getting a thing called WebAssembly. It's based on JavaScript. It is JavaScript bytecode, so you can take C and C++ and really compile it. Imagine a world where there are fewer app stores, and if you are getting a game, it could be a JavaScript-based game. Because why? You have a virtual machine on your phone that is not being utilized effectively. And so far, it's been an effort amongst all kinds of people. But the trick with WebAssembly is understanding what the metal means, right? What does it mean to be on the metal? The new metal is JavaScript and really understanding JavaScript. But people use jQuery and libraries to hide their understanding of JavaScript. They get a sense that, oh, well, jQuery lets me do everything, and I know how to use jQuery. I'm pretty slick. I'll be awesome. jQuery is going to be great. I'm going to do that one again just because it's awesome. All right. You got to understand the low-level stuff. Understand the DOM. Understand web workers. Understand the low-level stuff that's happening in JavaScript. But then I see people who are hiring, and they say nobody writes JavaScript anymore. They write jQuery. That's not okay. You know who says that? jQuery says that. jQuery. I was looking up jQuery, and I found this web. This is at Wikipedia. It says this is about the actor. For the JavaScript library, see jQuery. Someone typed in jQuery to learn about jQuery. So I just decided that jQuery said that, right? Because once you know that jQuery exists, you'll never use jQuery again. You're going to be at work later this week, and someone is going to say, should we use jQuery on this project? And you'll be like, I don't know. Let me check his IMDb page, and we'll see if jQuery is available for this job, because he's a pretty busy actor. jQuery does not like me. You get this image in your head of these amazing apps that you're going to build with JavaScript. But then when you make them, they don't quite turn out the way that you wanted them. And then you go looking for someone to blame, and it's not fair. So people need to start using things like vanilla JS, really understand what's going on at the root. I've always said that people should learn at least two languages, JavaScript and a systems language, and that's what I told this gentleman at Intel. I said, you want to be a web developer, learn JavaScript. Whatever you're doing, it's going to use JavaScript. And then learn some systems language. That might also be JavaScript, could be PHP, it could be C#, you don't know. But it's going to give you the ability to do something big and amazing on the server side, and something else on the client. And then start expecting more from your web tools. all of these things are actually coming together. They work really well. The pieces work well. In the old days, we used to sniff browsers. Now we check for features to see if a browser supports something. You should never be sniffing for browsers anymore. So the cloud means this massive scale and this programmatic elasticity, the ability to go and take my startup from one data center to 10, from one web server to a web farm. But I want to remind people that even low-end Android devices have a JavaScript virtual machine. They have accelerated graphics. And you can go and target those. I hear a lot that, oh, we have 3 machines in the web farm and we have 1,000 users. Well, what are those machines doing? I talked to one customer who was having it so when you click on a table to sort, they were sending the table back to the server and having it sort. Because we all know that your pocket supercomputer can't, you know, sort lists of 10 or even 20 items. They then thought, well, when I have 1,000 users hitting 3 machines, I really have 1,003 virtual machines. Could we bring that data local? Can we sort, manipulate, display that data with things like D3JS for visualization? So the user's virtual machine can be part of that cloud. Why don't you put that to work? Think about the level of sophistication of those systems and what's allowed. You can have a much, much better experience, and your cloud doesn't necessarily have to work so hard. So what I told this gentleman was, you know computer science. You have a background in languages like C and C++. You know the cloud. You've managed virtual machines. The cloud just makes it so it's not boring and dull anymore. With a virtual machine in the browser, you can program that. So I told him, you are powerful. You know more about this than you realized. So go out there and write some good code, and thank you very much.